Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.
All right, you're very welcome to a special panel tonight coming to you from the Spawell Golf Academy, newly reopened here in Temple Oak, just off the M50 by our good friend from Golf Weekly, Peter Laurie. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
We're in a darkened room just off the corner, but it's a lovely setup. It's fully refurbished. It's newly painted. This is the future.
Well, you'd want to be here 3 weeks ago. We've put some amount of work in it with 3 weeks. We pretty much ripped it apart and started again. So looking forward to opening it up now on Friday. So we'll see how it goes.
And you brought out the big guns as well. Your fellow European Tour winner, Damien McGrain, is here. And the new Ryder Cup captain, Padraig Harrington. How are you keeping?
Yeah, there you go.
Strong round of applause from your former European Tour colleagues.
It just goes to show I'm no longer three-time major winner.
It's in the past now. This is the thing about your legacy.
Yeah, let's hope that in 2 years' time, I'm still being introduced as the Ryder Cup captain, because that means things would have gone well. If it hasn't gone well, we'd be going back to three-time major winner.
You've come in here with a heavily bandaged left arm. What happened?
I broke it. Wrist just slipped. Going down the stairs 7:30 in the morning. Didn't think I'd done anything but sprained it at the time, and I ice compressed it, did all the normal stuff, and it didn't heal up, and turned out I'd broken it. And we're pretty sure it's very close to being fixed. Next week I'm going to be hitting shots, and assuming that there isn't any other damage with it, even though we've looked at it, but you know, who knows what's going on in the wrist. I should be okay next week and then start playing maybe in 2 weeks' time.
All right, very good. This is local for you, of course.
I grew up here. I grew up
just a couple of miles away?
Probably only about a mile, same as Peter. And I would have used this as a kid. I would have come up here at times and practiced during the winter when the Kennedys owned it back in the day. So, yeah, it's a pretty familiar ground here.
It's a pretty remarkable thing that both yourself and Paul McGinley went to the same school, both grew up in Rathfarnham, both went to Cláis de Éire. And Peter, another European Tour winner. Three European Tour winners from probably, what, 1-2 square miles?
Well, Peter's probably less than a par four away from me, house-wise. And Paul McGinley is actually about a mile only further away. So it's good golf in country, Rathfarnham. There's plenty of golf courses. So there's nothing more. If people sort of say, well, was there anything about the school or anything special? The only thing is, six golf courses all backing onto each other in Rathfarnham, good golf courses, and I think probably a little bit of competition because of that.
Did you have a connection growing up?
Oh yeah, very much so. Porrick's dad, Paddy, used to bring us to tournaments, and my dad used to bring us down to the odd tournament. We'd get there a little bit quicker when my dad drove. But
I never ceased to. I was always amazed with my dad. He never turned anybody down. There could be literally 8 kids with golf clubs getting into the car. It was like in nowadays with, you know, obviously with seatbelts and things, it just couldn't happen. But back in the day, we all just piled in, we got on with it, and it was different great days.
Absolutely.
What age was this?
Well, you're going back to the early 90s, if not before.
Right.
So, you know, living very close to each other was very handy. Porrick was a little bit older than me, but I was living up to, the Porrick, really, you know.
And were you trying to chase him down at that early stage?
No, he was always way better than I was.
I thought he was going to tell his favourite story about when we played foursomes in the Interpros. And I thought I was a really nice foursomes partner. I really thought I was. And he tells me, like, it took him 20 years to tell me how intimidating I was as a foursomes partner, and that I gave out to him on the 18th hole when he ran it. We had 2 putts to win and he ran it 2 feet by.
Oh yeah, he wasn't a good foursomes partner, you know what I mean? And he was probably one of the best putters at the time, but you couldn't. I was very aggressive putter, and he tried to smash it at the hole, but Porrick was, he'd always like to be, you know, leave it pretty close rather than leaving it with a 2-footer.
And did you hold the putt coming back?
I did, but seemingly I gave him a bollocking afterwards. and genuinely, I thought I was just really nice. The hard one was actually Damien McGrain. He was the guy he was the hardest guy. The one guy in the whole draw, I've always said this, you never wanted Damien in your side of the draw.
Why?
He's the guy that just never let you have anything. Would not make it easy, would not give you anything. At that time, I would have been, you know, of a high standing, and people used to tell me I'd turn up in my Irish jersey every day. And yeah, that would give you a one-hole start, but not against Damien. You just knew you were getting the toughest match of the week off Damien, no matter what. And you know, that was, it was one of those ones. There was guys that just knew that you were going to beat no matter what would happen. But Damien, you had to bring your game.
And was that true that you would turn up every day in your Irish jersey?
I didn't think I did, but that's what I'm told.
Was it something, obviously it's a long time ago now, but was it something you think when you look back, actually maybe I would have done that? It's quite intimidating that you're the big dog arriving in.
I remember once being told, a nice guy actually, he told me I always wore white shoes and I used to put them off. He'd see me on the green because I'd be wearing white golf shoes and I'd stand out. And, you know, again, this comes back maybe 5 years after we finished amateur golf, as I'm a pro, and it comes out, and I said, you know, I wore white golf shoes because that's what I got free when I played for Ireland. They were the only ones I had. And that's the way it was. I didn't buy a pair of golf shoes back in the day. If you were getting them free, that's what you wore.
Still,
you know?
Don't buy them.
It's true. I've never bought a golf... Well, I've nearly never ever bought a golf ball.
When was the last time you spent money on golf equipment?
I'd buy the odd training drill and aid. And yeah, I bought stuff last year, yeah. I'd have no problem going out if I had to buy something. But as I said, once in my life, I bought golf balls. And this is, I have to bring it up because it's a crazy story. So, 2007 Open, getting to the playoff. And Ronan, my caddy, had got six golf balls ready for the playoff that morning. Nothing to do with me. I would probably not be, not superstitious, but I wouldn't have been that organized. But he'd given them to his father to mind. He wasn't going to carry an extra six balls around the course. So both the lads here are nodding because they know Ronan's not going to take any extra weight. But we couldn't find his father between the finish and the playoff because there was obviously a melee of people around the first tee. So we sent my manager into the pro shop and he got six balls out of the pro shop, Carnoustie Pro Shop, logoed with Carnoustie on it. And I'm going to tee up with these golf balls with the logo. And just before I'm about to go, we find his dad, we get the golf balls. We didn't have to use the Carnoustie logo balls, but my manager was obviously in a rush and had to get the golf balls quickly and whatever. I was hunted down for those price of those six golf balls afterwards.
Did you not bring them back? No, sale and return, no.
I think I don't have the golf ball. I might have the golf ball I won with, but I know I still have those golf balls with the logo on them. But yeah, I'm signing all the autographs and all the posters and everything, and they're giving it. But by the way, yeah, it's £45 for these six balls.
I'd imagine your manager was sweating as well, probably with your golf ball deal, and this is the one that rolls into the hole to win the Open Championship.
No, it was same ball out of the shop. It just had the logo on it. You know, that's the great thing with the tightest ball, the one the pros use.
Everybody uses. Yeah. Damien, so Peter said he's a couple of years younger than Patrick, but you were the same age growing up. I'd imagine you came into contact quite a bit then.
Yeah, I was from County Meath, so possibly that was started off the rivalry. But from that point, I was purely into golf. So one of my earliest memories, it actually just came back to me right now. My dad dropped me up to Rathfarnham on a way to Leinster Trials in Carlow Golf Club. So he drops me up and we're all travelling, including Padraig, down with Mick McGinley to Carlow. But we had to go to Mass because Padraig and Caroline were at Mass. So we all went to Mass, sat there, and after the service, then we headed off to Carlow. So that was a memory from, I'd say we were 17 years of age. So that was a good start to our day. And, you know, it's great that golf has got us all back in this room tonight and we can actually sit and have a bit of a laugh at what happened back in the day. And at the time, it was important to us and they were all stepping stones. And fair play to Padraig, he fully deserves his Ryder Cup captaincy. He was always market leader. And for us golfers, he was always the one to catch. And he still is. And I'm looking forward to his Ryder Cup and seeing what exciting things happen.
And you all went on to live the dream and you all went on to win on the European Tour. And you all ultimately graduated quite late compared to what golfers are doing now and getting on tour at 19, 20, 21. When you were 16, 17, 18, competing against each other around Ireland, like, were you thinking about that then? Were you thinking, we're at the top of our game here, we can go on, we can make a livelihood out of this?
Well, I wanted to be a golf club professional. And I done my apprenticeship and my aspirations was to be a golf club professional. So When my golf kept improving, I then said to myself, maybe I'll have a go at the bigger time. So I started later, whereas Padraig would have had set his sights at the top and just went there. I was different. I sort of set the sights maybe a little bit low, but I became what I wanted to be. And when I was a young man, I wanted to be a golf club professional. Back then, as you know, the only thing, only golf on TV was the Masters of the British Open. So I didn't really have a lot of exposure to top class golf. But I'm glad I got out there in the end and had a good time, and I got to spend time with some of the greats of Ireland, yeah.
Why do you think your ambitions were slightly different?
They weren't, to be honest. At 18 years of age, I finished school like everybody else, and I didn't know what to do. I wanted to be involved in the golf industry, but I didn't think I was good enough to be a touring pro. Those guys who were touring pros, we had them up on a pedestal. We thought they were unbelievable. And to be honest, okay, the Irish guys, we somewhat would have had some idea of, but I definitely had them all up on a pedestal. So when I was 18, I went and did accountancy at night. My brother brought me by the hand and enrolled me. That, you know, literally that is essentially how I ended up doing accountancy. And like only 2 or 3 years into that, I started seeing, just like Damien, hang on a second here, I'm starting to beat the guys who think they're good enough. And I'm beating them all the time. So, you know, maybe I should have a go at this. But to be honest, most of the time doing that accountancy, and it, you know, it took me 4.5 years to get through it. Most of the time I was thinking, I'm going to work in the golf industry. So managing a golf resort, something like that. And you know, back then you'd be surprised, you know, 30 years ago, which is close to now. Yeah, it is, yeah, 30 years. I wasn't aware of the jobs in the golf industry. You know, I wasn't aware of being a player agent or something like that. This is in the 80s. You just didn't think outside the box like that. And, you know, if I was aware of it, maybe I would never actually turn pro. I would have, might have gone down the safer route of just being involved around golf. I love playing it. But like anybody else, I would have had the fear, oh, well, I'm not good enough. These are stars. And that was a big issue when I did turn pro. I end up, pretty quickly, you're teeing up and you're playing with Ernie Els, Retief Goosen. And these are guys I put up on a pedestal for sure. And you have to get over that. It's not easy.
How do you get over that?
A very, very simple way. A guy, it would have come to a fore when I about my second year on tour, I'm going head-to-head on the Sunday against Monty. And Monty, obviously, like, he's way up there on a pedestal. And I'm working with a guy called Josh Van Stipoff, who was a sports psychologist. His qualification to be a sports psychologist, the two lads here are smiling, his qualification was he had a top 20 in the Belgian pop charts. No other qualification. This man was the greatest. Look, if you ever want to make some money in life and you're not, you know, there, being a sports psychologist, the sports, you know, it's just, if you get it right with one player, you'll have 10 the following week. And Josh had two guys in the playoff in Muirfield in 2002. And we worked with Michael Campbell, Ernie Els, lots of good guys. And to be honest, you know, when I worked with him, we were talking with the Monty incident. I'm going in to play the final round and I'm sitting there going, wow, how am I going to beat him? I'm going to have to play up to this level. And very simply, and I know this is going to be a cliche and everybody's wishing that I'm going to give him the ultimate answer here, but ultimately you tend to put people up on that pedestal and then you tend to really drag yourself down a bit. If you play your game, it's a little bit better than you think, and everybody else's game is not quite as good as what you think. So, for example, in the 10 years, I think, you know, say up to 2008 with Tiger Woods, I'm the only player who played with Tiger more than 10 times and has a better strokes record in those rounds. And the reason being is Tiger's better than me. But if I play my game, Tiger should win 60% of the time and me 40% of the time. But the reality is Tiger's not used to it. It's a bit like, playing against Damien McGrain. Tiger's not used to people hanging around. He's used to people shooting themselves in the foot and actually, you know, destroying their own game, and Tiger then moves away and it's easy. You hang in there with somebody who's better than you and make them beat you. They have to play golf to beat you and they're not used to that. And it comes down right down to the end, right to the stretch. And the reality of with golf, it can swing either way down the last couple of holes. You know, it really, really can. I had it done to me in my last tournament, in the tournament with Matthew Pavin in the Czech Open. Like, literally, I had won the tournament after say 69 holes or 68 holes, he hits a hot run for 3 holes and there's no more holes left. And this is the, you know, if that was a 75 hole tournament or 78 hole, I would have probably come back in. But he timed his run right. And that's what I did a lot with Monty Tiger. I just played my game. And it's a cliche. You just got to be yourself and put it up to somebody.
I've heard you talk before about your first ever event as a professional and making the cut and saying you made the cut without playing your best stuff. And that gave you a sense of belonging that actually I can just get better here.
There's a huge comfort zone to going out there and playing and performing average and still getting by. I see the young guys going out on tour, and this is we spend our life on tour discussing this. We're watching these young, talented players. And between the three of us, there's none of us sitting here going, well, we were the most talented players and the best ball strikers. We see these kids, and some of them are awesome. But if you get that start, you know, you play, especially if you go out the first tournament and you play well and miss the cut, all of a sudden you're going, oh, my God, I'm not good enough. I've got to change everything. Whereas I got to start where I played bad and made the cut. Now, I hold every putt and chipped and chipped and putted everything and got lucky. But I didn't see that. I just said, oh, I'm good enough. I'm actually, even on my bad week, I make a cut. And that's huge comfort. And the lads will tell you, it just gets exponentially harder when you, and I would back in this boat now the last couple of years, when you feel you have to play your very best golf and you're hanging around that cut line playing your best golf, it just gets harder. When you feel like you're on a good run and making the cut is well within you and you start focusing on top tens and things, it just gets so much easier. And yet there's not a huge difference in the standard of play. It's just a huge difference in your perception. And when you're on that cut line, the two boys will tell you at the end of your careers, that's what tells you.
The cut is, you actually start playing for the cut, unfortunately. And how many tournaments, I think we all here in the room, have missed by one shot? Or, you know, it's incredible. But we were the type of players who would fight and fight and fight to try and make the cut. Mm. Because we knew if we could get past the cut line, we could have a very good tournament. I don't know how many times I just made the cut and finished top 10. But it is very difficult. As you get that little bit older, you start seeing the cut line as your tournament rather than the actual tournament.
You obviously won Rookie of the Year in your first full year on the tour. Did you then instantly also feel like I belonged here, even though you'd grown up watching a lot of these players on television? Like, were you ever overawed by anyone on the course?
No, not really, no. I winning Rookie of the Year was kind of a shock more than anything else, because I thought, cheekers, you know, I didn't feel like Rookie of the Year, let's put it that way. I think I got lucky, to be honest with you, for the standard that was there. You know, they were better than me. But, and, you know, nobody had a good enough year like, you know, I did. But I remember one story about Josh, and it's quite a, you know, I went to try and work with him in Germany one year. I went up to the range and I said, look, Josh, really interested in working with you. He says, oh, meet me in the hotel at 4 o'clock. So I went down to the hotel at 4 o'clock. And he'd been, he'd had a few drinks.
Josh is one of the great guys, he was a functioning alcoholic.
So sit down, and he abruptly says, do I want something? I said, no, I'm grand, I'll just have a cup of tea. And so I had a cup of tea, and we had a chat, unfortunately or fortunately, I don't know which one the way you put it, I have a very inquisitive mind. So I started asking Josh all about himself. You know, and I never got the story of that he was whatever, an entertainer. But so he says, right, we'll start working tomorrow. I'll see you on the range, you know, an hour and a half before you play. I said, that's great. Perfect. Shook his hand, did a deal, and off I went. The very next day, I'm on the range looking out for him. No sign of him. And then he walks past me just about before I'm to tee off and ignores me. And then never spoke to me for a full year after that. And I go, what did I do? You know what I mean? Obviously, I asked him too many questions.
Wow. And did you get in touch with Josh through Podrick?
No. Josh was out on tour for many, many years. Unfortunately, you know, God rest his soul, he's passed away now. But he was a lovely man. But definitely out there.
Josh was one of the greatest guys when you weren't working with him. He's great fun. You know, great to be around. He knew all the stories. He had it all. When you're working with him, it was always, he's a little bit disheveled. He's drinking, you know, he's aggressive. His language can be terrible. That, you know, he's one of those guys you kind of go, but when he's not your guy, he's just great fun.
Yeah. Did you indulge him any? Psychologist?
Not a Padraig. Chance. Padraig seems to think, seems to know something about this.
I don't think Damien
no,
ever
I managed to, there were like a prima donna walking onto the driving range, and yet they never owned a set of golf clubs. They didn't own golf shoes. They wore sunglasses, and they never seemed to get rattled or fazed over anything. I felt that the only people actually at a golf tournament working were the players and the caddies, and the hangers-on were just... You know, they're like feral dogs hanging around waiting for something to fall. You know, and they'll pick it up and eat it, you know. So if a vulnerable golfer is just after having a bad day, along comes the wolves and hopes to pick you up off the ground, and then you get the invoice a week or two later. So, you know, I would have had the opinion that golf comes from within. A good player has self-belief. When you're playing well, even when you hit a ball into the water, it'll bounce out. When your game is on and when you're playing well, you naturally, things will naturally happen. So I would have had the belief that it's all within, and the player is good enough to get there, and he's also good enough to get it over the line. Sure, every now and then, some of us need a bit of reassurance or somebody to put their arm around you and say, listen, it'll be all right. But with experience, eventually you don't need your hand to be held. Padraig doesn't need his hand to be held. He's confident in his own skin and he knows what he's doing. And I think at the end of our careers, we all probably got to that point. But at the start, for sure, you reach out and you will accept help off anybody who's willing to offer it. But what happens with players is the psychologists generally go fishing for the business.
Yeah, he's 100% right. There's too many people waiting for the guy just to slip a little bit, and the coaches and you can't blame the coach. If the coach is there, he's making sure he's within view, earshot, and the player is struggling, he'll go, well, what are you thinking?
Is that how that dynamic works? They literally just stand, as where we often get in the media, just stand at the back of the range and maybe stand behind and watch your swing and
we've seen a lot of young players lose their way because, as I said, they don't get a quick start, they don't feel comfortable, and then all of a sudden they think they have to change everything that got them there, which is disaster. You should, like, if I was going to sell anything to a young guy going out on tour, he's changed nothing for 2 years. After 2 years, you'll know whether you're good enough or not good enough, whether you need to change part of your game or some of your game or none of your game. But after 2 weeks or 6 weeks, you have no idea where you stand in the pecking order. But they'll be straight into a new coach. And we've seen it. If you see a young guy out there and he's gone through two or three coaches in the first 6 months, just hasn't got a chance.
Yeah, like we could have called that Matteo Manassero was one in particular, who came out of the blocks, did exceptionally well, and then all of a sudden had a bit of a lull, and you see him starting working with a few different coaches, and you think, uh-oh, you know, you could nearly, you know, say it straight away that there's going to be a problem here for a couple of years, because you start going down a route, and it's very difficult to turn back from that. Once you start changing your swing the wrong way, it's very difficult to get back.
Would you have been chalk and cheese the way you looked at the game of golf? It feels from the outside as though
we'd be very similar.
Okay.
Incredibly similar, actually.
I would have thought from afar that you almost spent your career searching for that extra little bit the whole time, whereas you sort of spent your career looking at your God-given talent, trying to avoid anything that would change that might compromise that.
No, but we had the same fight. We had the same attitude out there. We had the same self-belief, self-confidence. I would look at Damien and say, well, what's making it work for him? And you know, he'd be one of the players. Consistently say this to I know Damien's not on tour now, but we consistently said it in the latter years on tour. You know, people would turn up, young amateurs go watch golf, and they go and watch. Nowadays, they would say they go and watch Tiger Woods, or Dustin Johnson, or somebody like, and they'd learn 100 times more watching Damien McGrain get the golf ball around the golf course, because he didn't have the 320-yard drives, and he didn't have whatever, but Damien performed to the top of the game, and there's where you're seeing somebody and you can learn more than necessarily you go watch a player that you have up on a pedestal and you don't even see. I guarantee you, if you send somebody out to watch the top player in the world, say you've sent somebody out to watch Justin Rose number one now, they'd never see a bad shot for the whole day because they're just so blinkered with it. And they think that he never hit a bad shot. And they'd be sitting there afterwards saying all they can remember is the good shots. Where it's the recovery from the bad shots, it's the attitude after a bad shot. It could be the attitude after good shots. You know, we learn as a pro when things are going well, you've got to push really hard. And, you know, you learn that when things aren't going well, just hang in there and wait for it to turn. But, you know, you don't see that when you're watching somebody who's on a beautiful run. And this, we've all seen it. You sit there and you see an average player go on a run for 18 months. And, like, sometimes they don't even know it themselves how many times they're just getting, you know, every time they make a bogey, they birdie the next hole. It's not hard to play golf like that, is it?
Do you know, Nathan, these two lads here are very, very similar and they don't realise it. You know, I've shared with Damien for many, many years and I've known Porrick for many, many years. They are pretty, pretty similar on the golf course. Once the first tee goes of a golf tournament, I would say there's not a lot of difference between them.
In what way?
Just they were, the way they played the game. They never worried about which way they hit it. That didn't bother them. They never worried about which way they swung it on a golf course. All they were engrossed in getting the ball from A to B. That was it. They could get it up and down from a bottle. That was their games. Off the golf course, probably two totally different people. But on the golf course, very, very similar.
Did you all come on to tour? I know you were on earlier, onto the tour, Potter, but did you come on at a very good time from an Irish point of view where there was all these experienced heads around the place? Like, I've heard of 7 o'clock in the evening, you all go down for dinner together.
There was 14 on tour when I started.
Wow.
And you know, and some of them were seriously the experienced older guys. You're looking at Des Smith, who was like dad on tour. He controlled everything. You know, if a player was getting out of line, Des was the one who would say it to them. If a player was trying too hard, if a player wasn't working hard, Des would be the one that would be the one encouraging them. That, you know, and more so, believe it or not, in professional golf, you're more likely to find a player who's over trying. You know, who just can't relax. And, you know, the one thing you've got to understand in golf, we work, you kind of take it as a given, we're going to work really hard or harder than everybody else because that's what got us there. But you have to be able to get away from it. You have to get your mind off it in the evening times. You have to, that's a huge part of being a successful golfer is that break away from it. And you know, having other Irish guys, as I said, when I started out, was a huge for me. It was, and you know, I especially, you know, starting my career, I would have been, you know, quite focused, and you know, it was great that I just had automatically, you know, 14 guys that were always there to go and have dinner with, to have a chat with, to be your help. And you know, you had people like Eamon Darcy and Chris O'Connor Jr. and like, not just experience, but very good people to be around in terms of just life stories and entertaining, and there was a variety. The lads came a little later on tour, but you know, to be a huge amount. I know me coming second time around back to Europe and that, when the lads were there, I couldn't believe how much I'd missed it by being in the States. Golf is very, very lonely in the States compared to Europe. Europe is just brilliant in that sense.
Yeah, if you don't know your college football, you're probably struggling when you're out for dinner.
If you don't know college sport in the States, and we just don't get it, it's fascinating. And the lads, I don't know if they know this, but I'm sure I've said it. Like, the lads all carry their college colours on their golf bags. They carry the actual bag with the full bag. Could be, they've done a semester in college. Like, they've all, there's not one of them that hasn't flunked out of college. And yet they carry a badge. Like, we know, if you flunk out of college here, those 3 years never appear in your CV. I was travelling the world.
I was never there, yeah. I spent one class once in Rathmines Tech.
I started in Rathmines.
Yeah, there you go. Before, my brother, too, grabbed me by the hand and says, right, you're doing night commerce in UCD, and that's it. But, yeah, look.
Our two older brothers were best friends.
Right.
Yeah. Like, they're still our best friends
okay.
these days.
Yeah, very much so.
Was golf off limits in those 7 o'clock in the evening dinners after a round, or would you go back and spill out everything that had happened?
Oh, you certainly wouldn't spill out everything that happened. You wouldn't, you just, nobody would want to listen to you. But if there's something interesting happened, you know, if a guy did something, you know, crazy happened, absolutely. I enjoy talking about golf, but I'm just not going to. I'm not interested if the guy comes in and says I three put at the last.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah, so I three put. Yeah, so I three put it yesterday. You know, you're just not into. But if a guy comes in and says, you know, you can't believe what your man did down this hole. He clearly hit it into the hazard here, and he dropped it over there. And you know, anything out of the ordinary, any funny rulings, any stupid things, anything crazy. And fair enough, if somebody came in and they, you know, they made three eagles that day. Yes, they could tell us they made three eagles, but not I three put at the last.
Damien probably has one of the best stories. I remember coming in and he came in with a beauty with the Jose Maria Lara's caddy. That was a good story, no?
Yeah, again, you have all sorts of things happen in your career, and this particular day, this caddy, you know, he possibly had an out-of-body experience and he dumped a golf club in a bush off the front of the second tee box.
He had 15 clubs in the bag.
So he dumps a club, and I watched this caddy charge into a bush head first. And I said to my caddy, can you see what this guy's after doing? He's some idiot, isn't he? And he's going, oh, yeah, forget about it, mate. So I walked up the fairway, and then I said, no, this is not right. So I turned back around, walked back down towards the second tee box, and I meet the guy coming out of the bush, and I said, what's going on? So then he blurts out that he's panicked and didn't know what to do, and he's just dumped the club, and then the whole saga went on from there. Then he had to go tell his boss. Then his boss is coming over to me, and I don't know if he's going to say, it's none of your business, Damien, or what the hell are you talking about? He didn't dump the club. I didn't know what was going to happen. So it kicked off from there, and it sort of spoiled the weekend, and it was a bit weird for everybody involved. So It wouldn't be one of my best stories now, but I have a few good ones, but it wouldn't be one of the best ones.
What are your few good ones then?
No. I listened to Padraig here, and certain things have started coming back to me. But,
oh, yeah?
You know, when you asked Padraig about timing and starting on tour, I was listening to his answer, but my answer to the same question would have been, I was lucky that I started on the tour in 2003. And I would have said that what was good for me was, like, the Irish economy went into recession, and we were recession proof because we were on the tour wheeling and dealing. We couldn't lose. So when
Speak
the Irish when everybody else was in distress, we were away, and everybody was looking at us dreaming about what it'd be like to play even for one day on the tour. And we were recession proof. So, like, that's how I would have seen where we were lucky. We could have been on tour and come off in the recession. We actually were abroad for the recession playing golf. And as I said, recession proof, which to me would have been how I found the whole scenario, that it was just luck. And Nathan, luck is very important. Certain things happen in your life.
Yeah.
And we happened, us. It was Peter and I especially, we happened to be away and immune to it. So that's how I'd see it with the timing.
Yeah, like we were coming on tour in 2003, but poor Porrick there probably made a load of money and lost it in the recession.
I was thinking as it was all going to pot in 2009, he's just won three majors. He's getting the big appearance fees. He's like, screw you guys. Yeah. The boom is still going here.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's still going. Yeah.
Yeah. Going even more now with Ryder Cup captaincy.
Yeah, I know, yeah.
Look at McGinley, how much he made out of it.
When you look at the tour now then compared to when you started, and there was 14 Irish when you come in, and at the moment, probably with European Tour cards, there'd be yourself, Shane Lowry, Paul Dunne, and Gavin Moynihan. And Gavin Moynihan hasn't even got a start yet so far this year. Do you think it'd be as enjoyable to be starting out as a 20-something-year-old out on tour?
If you want it to be. You know, Dunners is quite a bit younger than Shane, and substantially younger than me. The three of us go out for dinner nearly as many nights as suits us. So you wouldn't, with 14, every night suits a number of them. With three guys, depending on tee times, guys won't make it if they want to go to the gym or want to do extra practice. But if there's any young guy out there and wants to join, there's always one or two of us going, or one. So it's still there. And it's still, and when you come to dinner, you know, it really is, there's no airs and graces. You're all just there for dinner. You get on with it. So yeah, if there's young guys come out on tour, they will find a very nice home with the older guys.
They abuse the young lads now, though, because they play credit card roulette. I got abused a long time ago, but now they really get abused.
I it's amazing to me because I wasn't involved with all this. So since I've come back in the last two years, they have this credit card roulette. So at the end of dinner, if you want to sit at the dinner table, you throw the credit card in and whoever's last one out pays for the meal. So it kind of does... It does scare the odd person away, all right.
Wouldn't have been great with 14 at dinner.
Yeah, in a fancy steakhouse. Yeah.
What do you miss most, Damien, from being out on tour? Or anything?
I had a lifespan and a shelf life on the European tour. I was delighted to get out onto the tour. I was delighted to get up to the end of 2015. And in the end, I was looking forward to getting out. I'd done my bit. I'd nothing left to prove. I'd nothing left in the tank either. As the two lads commented earlier, eventually to make the cut, you had to actually play okay. So the fun was gone out of it. And when I came to the end, I kissed everybody goodbye and walked away. I was very happy to see the end. And I was only happy because I had such a good run now, Nathan. But I knew the end would come, and when it did come, I was happy, and I was waiting for it to come because I got through 2013, 14, and then at the end of 15, I was culled, which is fine because you have to make way because the younger players like Gavin Moynihan, the older guys, which we eventually became or are, get out of the way and let the younger players on with it. So at the end, I was happy, lucky, and I was very content to walk away.
What about you?
No, I wasn't content at all. No way. I really missed the competing end of it. That's the biggest thing. I don't miss the travelling. I don't miss being away from home. But just the competing end of it, I really miss. And I haven't. And I've certainly searched for something that is a that could replace that. I haven't found it as of yet. But
golf podcast every Thursday.
Oh, it's great. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Getting slagged every Thursday is wonderful. You know?
I have to say. On tour, European tour, 110 guys at the end of the year have their card. There's probably 175 guys at the start of the year who tell you they have their card. So that you're literally looking there at 65 guys each year that lose their card and only 110 keep it. So you're going over a two-year period, you're looking at 100% turnover of players who have their card. It is amazing the attrition out on tour. Anybody who stays out there, and it's going to get worse, by the way. So you, with the way the game is going, you will find in the future, players will keep their card for 2-3 years, lose their card, and come back and get it again. But having careers like Phil Mickelson lasting, 30, it's just not going to happen. Even the good players having a bad year, they're going to go. So you're going to see a lot of shorter careers, a lot of ups and downs, and maybe revivals in the career because consistency is no use anymore. Consistency, you're going to miss the cut. You need exceptionally good play and rubbish play. That's the best way to have it. So this is why you see more long hitters doing well, because like I go back to the same golf course I might have played even 5-6 years ago, and I might go to a par four that I hit an iron off or hit forward. No, driver now. I take a chance, drive it up past the bunker. If I hit it in the bunker and make bogey, I'm missing the cut this week. If I don't hit it in the bunker up there, maybe I make birdie, and that's the only way I can shoot 20 under par to win it. So there's a lot more pressure on the players to play their absolute best, whereas, certainly 20 years ago, consistency was definitely a great way to go.
You're going to have to go and cut a ribbon in a couple of minutes and open this place officially, but you probably had a bit of time, I'd imagine, with the injury to think about what happens over the next 18 months. And I remember when Paul McGinley got the job as Ryder Cup captain, you were saying along that time that like the playing side, it takes a back seat. And I guess mentally, that feels like it for you at this stage of your career, it still almost feels like it's too soon to be for your playing career to be taking a back seat.
Well, I like playing golf. So over the last couple of years, my game wasn't quite as good. And I kind of was looking at it and going, I did a bit of commentary, did that and the other. And I'm going, then I went, I like playing golf. I like being out on tour. I like the traveling, everything that goes with it, I like. So, yeah, the Ryder Cup takes away a little bit from that. Being in an away match, there's not as much to do. And obviously that will ramp up next year. So I'm hoping to have a good year's golf. And then, 6 months of not such a, watching these guys. And then obviously after that, who knows, I'll be close enough to the senior tour. Hopefully I'll have the physical ability to keep competing on the main tour for a number of more years. But the one thing I've figured out in my life is I like doing what I do.
But do you need a different outlook now when you wake up and you walk out onto a range in the morning? If you're in a bad mood, if you're a bit pissed off, you can't just put your head down anymore, I guess. You're the Ryder Cup captain. You have to exude confidence. And if you see one of your possible players, they want to get a nice word from the captain.
Yeah, you know, I going back to enjoying it, I think I went three years there back. Back when I was winning majors, maybe I should go back and do this. I'd say I went 3 years without eating a burger. No chips, no burger for like years. The focus and the commitment of what, you know, diet wise, gym wise. I'm soft now. I'm lazy now. I enjoy myself. I'm not the person I was 10 years ago. And that doesn't worry me. You know, I know I can play good enough golf, but I see these guys out there and, you know, the commitment they have and all that. And going, yeah, I did that. You know, that was me 15 years ago. Yeah. You know, that protein shake, you know, and if you went out and tour now, half the guys are having protein shakes and this, that, and the other. And I'm looking at it going, I'd rather eat those calories in a chocolate cake. Because in the end of the day, it's all calories going in. So, yeah, you know, but I've earned that. That's what I feel like. I've earned the fact, yes, I have done it. I've done all that stuff. Now I'm ticking over and enjoying what I do.
Shane Lowry gave you a nice early headache anyways. A good start.
Yep. Myself and Peter were discussing it before we came in there. You could not pick a better golf tournament for Shane to win at this time. It gets him right back into the top 50, playing the majors, playing the world events. It is so difficult to make the Ryder Cup team starting next September if you're not in the top 50. If you're trying to make it by playing the small, it just doesn't happen. If you're in those big events, you only need, you know, two or three of them play well in and you're right there. And there's some, you know, it's a must, and he has done exactly what it's not going to get him in the team in the end of the day, winning a tournament 18 months beforehand, but it puts him in a position that it will be within his control.
He has to what, pay for all the drinks at the Christmas outing? Is that the punishment for victory?
Do
you still get invited?
Oh, that's a contentious issue there. Let's
not go down that road. Wow.
They were there this year.
Yeah. Hold on, myself and Damien. And we got to get these facts right here, okay?
So this is your end-of-year Christmas drinks everybody who's on tour, all the Irish on tour together.
Myself and Damien McGrain started the Christmas do, okay? We started it, okay? And recently, we didn't even get invited.
Wow.
I saw you there this year.
I only got invited at the very last minute by your caddy, who's actually a friend of mine, okay? But I didn't see you picking up the phone.
Oof. I had nothing to do with the Christmas.
Oh, well, there you go. And the year previous to that, a certain person who's only newly on the tour decided, let's invite nobody. Ooh. Certainly not the McGrain and myself.
Wow.
So I really want to make that statement. Would you back me up there, Damien?
Peter, why are you holding on to the past? we're now in the library on the top shelf that nobody goes to. Right, you know what I mean? Like, who cares? And... You know, the guys now have new conversation, new thoughts. We can't relate to it anymore because we're outside the window looking in. So let them off. Let them have their fun.
Wow.
That's my opinion.
This is the sort of back and forth that could go down really well in the Ryder Cup team room, I think.
Yeah. You know, the older guys who I started out on tour, they have a Christmas party too. So there's
maybe we'll be invited. Bitter and twisted, haven't I?
I'm saying you're going to have to start an older guys party. So there'll be a really older guys, a medium older guys, and
on the podcast we actually don't have to mind our P's and Q's. We can pretty much say what we like.
Yeah.
So I have to be very careful here. So I will do that on the podcast.
Lads, we really do need to actually open the Spawell Golf
would
Academy.
Be a good idea.
Your wife outside is getting angrier by the minute, I'd imagine. Peter, very best of luck with it over
the coming years.
Damien, thanks a lot. As always, we'll have to get down to Carlo
again. Thanks, Nathan. Yep.
And Podrick, very best of luck. I'm sure we'll be chatting over the next 18 months. And when you get the wrist fixed, best of luck on the course as well.
Thank you, Nate.
Off the ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.